Welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty, and I'll be hosting the show today as we discuss Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Noah Harari. My guests are Peter Host and Matt Horner. Welcome.
Howdy.
Thank you.
So, Peter, you picked this book. Why I invited you to be on the show again. Is there something about this book that you wanted to do it on the radio?
Well, I was really excited to take on this book because I had read his first book, Sapiens, which kind of encapsulates humankind, you know, as much as possible into one book. And then this was Where We Go From Here, supposedly. So I was excited to take in what his vision for now and the future are, having already read through what he said about the past.
And I'm thinking I might want to go back and read that one after this one. So we have a lot to talk about. This book is just chock full of big ideas. So we're going to tackle some of them, and we'll see how far we get, and then decide if we're actually going to do a second show on the book. So Harari lays the groundwork for his thesis by giving a history of where humans have come from, where we are now, and then ends with his prediction of where we're going. And so that's where he gets the title, Brief History of Tomorrow. So he starts with the argument that humans have conquered plague, famine, and war. What do you think of that premise? Do you think that we have to accept that we've conquered those things before we can go on to his predictions?
I'd like to just suggest that conquered is a big word. It's kind of a finality. Certainly we've made headway there, but we're still biological beings. We still need to produce food. So famine is a possibility. In my estimation, and we haven't figured out how to work together without conflict. So war also is in there as well, plague. So I think we need to be mindful that we're still biologically functioning organisms, and we may not have conquered. We've made some headway, though.
And I think we've made headway to the point where they are no longer our they won't be our primary problems moving forward. One of the things that he talks about that I think is really meaningful is just the death rates of children for most of history. I mean, you had a bunch because a lot of them were going to die. Now the expectation is, unless you live in a country that is currently like war-torn or hit by famine on a large level, that your children, outside of some kind of accident or neglect, are going to make it. And that was not an expectation at all for most of human history. And that in many ways, we may not have implemented a lot of our solutions to these problems to their full capacity, but we have gotten to a point where we do have solutions for them, and science continually does even better. If we had some kind of equality of the spread of our solutions, that'd probably be the finality of a lot of these problems, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. And Harari also points out that people now are dying because they eat too much, which is an interesting thing to observe.
And basically, I think what he was getting at is just, if you look at the numbers or percentages, that's where the impact is. Because, you know, like you said, just when we look at the number of children that have died, it's not for the same reasons as it has been in the past.
Yeah.
Or entire civilizations being wiped out by disease.
So. Yeah. When he talks about each of these items individually, plague, he talks about the different things that took out Native Americans when white people came to the shores. And he talks about the Black Plague and other things, and how those took out, more than half of populations. And that's a real plague. Now it's considered a crisis if something spreads beyond the borders of one country and kills like over 1,000 people.
Right.
You know, versus our total population, that's such a small thing, but we still freak out, and that's a big crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that one won't come to fruition, but the thought is that we will be able to tackle whatever new germ or virus manages to come across us and find us as a waiting victim,
So I guess we will say that we can see that there's been progress, but it's not that these things have been eliminated completely.
I mean,
it's sort of like the argument about, with climate change, that people say, you know, why would we want to do these things? We're not feeling the effects right now so much. And the one author I had read said something about we didn't, you know, kill all the horses when we moved to get the cars. So it's like, it's not that human beings say, oh, okay, now we can move on. You know, we've completely solved this problem. The thinking is that we kind of see the next step. And, you know, because we made progress on the previous.
Yeah. So, but I do think that accepting the idea that these have become the more minimal problems of humanity and that we need to kind of move forward and reprioritize what we focus on as a species is a good point, and that I accept that premise.
Okay.
I agree.
So then what Harari says is his prediction is that the next targets for humanity are immortality, happiness, and divinity. So let's talk about those in relation to where we are and what we can expect or predict. So when he talks about immortality, I thought it was fascinating to think that really medicine hasn't extended our lives. What it made possible was that more of us would reach that kind of the upper limits of what our bodies can now, you know, live to.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting how just turning a phrase differently can open up your eyes. He talked about modern technology and modern medicine now as reducing premature death.
Right.
And he looked at a lot of the things that people die from as technical glitches. In continuing with his AI theme, artificial intelligence theme, and data, et cetera, he approaches medicine even from that perspective, that there's a technical glitch. There's a problem with the system that can be technically solved. And I was fascinated. That's in the beginning of the book. And he talks about how we can extend our lifespan. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And he uses a term, I don't know if it's in this book or Sapiens, but rather than immortal, amortal, basically, where obviously getting your head chopped off still kills you. But anything short of that, essentially, there will be a way to extend life pretty much indefinitely, far into the future. And there would be, I'm really interested in later we'll talk about how that would work in class structure. Those who can afford to live for 170 years and those who can only live like 65 based on your income, those kinds of things. I think that this project of happiness and divinity and immortality is kind of the next logical step if you have solved the things in a large way that kill us off in large numbers or that cause the greatest amount of suffering. And we've made so much progress like we talked about, that the next is, how do we improve upon what we already are?
In the quality of life. And that's kind of like what I sum it up as, is that, yeah, we don't have those same problems that are going to kill us off so soon. So how do we make this better for us?
Mm-hmm. And then the unknowns there with respect to normal experiences like a marriage that lasting for hundreds and hundreds of years, mm-hmm. or a job. And he talks a little bit about that. Discusses how it's good to have new people coming into positions and providing fresh ideas, and how that may not be the case. So there are some potential threats to creativity that come along with people living so much longer than we already do. And I've been discussing this book with people, and I've observed that when I talk about that concept, some people say, I don't want that. I'm happy with whatever it is, 85 years. Versus living for hundreds of years. It's kind of overwhelming, and I'm happy to have my life and then be gone. So,
And I think that's because we think in terms of that quality again. And right now, when we look at people who are 85 plus, we think, oh my gosh, you know, they're so limited in their ability to move around, and maybe cognitively they're not as sharp. Their social world has shrunk. And so, you know, we look at that and think, you know, how long would I want to be in that phase of my life? As opposed to what he's getting at, which is, you know, with all the repairs and, you know,
they'd be spiking volleyballs.
It precisely.
Yep. mm-hmm. Yeah. And in a case where you can potentially genetically modify yourself? When do you get just emotionally and spiritually tired of being here? Which was fascinating.
You haven't watched enough vampire shows to have a sense of that.
Yeah, I like vampire shows. So.
Thousands of years, and they're still reinventing themselves. So with the happiness portion of it, and my background is psychology, and Matt, I know your background is psychology too. Peter's, your background is not.
Nothing really.
Oh, okay. Harari really does a lot of work with the psychological concepts and research. So I was kind of interested in that because, I mean, he's a historian. But so one of the things he talks about is, with happiness, how we've even seen on an international level where countries are looking at this gross national happiness as opposed to gross national product. So there's a sense of, as a collective, how do we increase happiness or well-being?
Yeah. And, that extending from the humanist idea that each human has like intrinsic and inherent value. So then the greatest good is to increase the happiness factor for each individual as much as possible. But we actually had a conversation about this. I don't know in what context where, I talked about. So what then would be wrong with finding a version of opioid that didn't have like the negative health effects. And if you could just take something that you just felt good all the time, and there weren't adverse side effects to you or the people around you, but you just you just coasted up here at a really happy state. Is there something then wrong with that? If so, what? And I found that fascinating. If happiness is the goal and you can attain it chemically, why not do that?
And I teach intro to psychology. And when I ask that question, because when we talk about, we have mood stabilizers and we have drugs that do that. We talk about, what's a baseline for individuals. And then we have our spikes, right? And that's what Harari talks about too, is, physiologically and psychologically, we're able to have greater feelings of happiness at times, but then those drop down. And so, I pose that question to students. Why not be able to stay up there? Why not be able to have that greater feeling of happiness? And I say, I've got $5 happiness pills here right now. Who wants to buy one? Nobody will.
Yeah, we're really grounded in our reality as we see it, which is that. And this is when I work with people on happiness or talk about happiness, I think it's kind of a little bit of a pie in the sky idea. To me, it's more about achieving the ability to balance yourself and to regulate and to be able to experience some of the melancholy aspects of life as well. So when I think of being able to take a pill for that or experience some kind of a simulation, or a stimulated simulation. I think of somebody that, from my personal perspective, is kind of avoiding life. And that Peter's discussion, when we had that discussion, that was very challenging for me. Because if everybody does that for long enough, that becomes the new reality. And Harari talks about that a little bit, that what do we do? Is there anything wrong with people just feeling good all day and being hooked up to some kind of a device that keeps them there and takes care of their physical needs, and they don't have any worries. Mm-hmm. And they still have experiences from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Brave New World, Huxley's book, where they take Soma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I make that point too, because Huxley believed, or the way he wrote the book anyway, is that when people are feeling that sense of well-being or happiness, they're not productive. But research says that we're more productive when we're happy. So you actually increase, and I think, now we kind of get that makes sense, that, when you feel good, you feel like doing things and you're more engaged and you're, working harder. So it's not that, we would just all sit around and have, fantasies about unicorns and rainbows.
Yeah. And it begs the question then as well, where's the value in suffering? And then how much of it do you allow to happen to people in order to find that value? There's a lot of artists who, and some folks want to be artists who I've met personally, who are kind of in love with their own pain, in love with their own sadness. And if they didn't have it, they wouldn't be them. And thus, almost less happy or fulfilled in some way. It's so integral to who they are that they wouldn't want it to go away.
Where would all of our music go? Yeah,
yeah.
Terrible music.
Yes, it would be.
Just to piggyback on that, though, in talking about this book is about the future, right? But it's you have to incorporate the history, and Harari does a great job doing that. But our history is growth through struggle. That's how, in large part, we got here. That's how we became the species that we are. So there may be something ingrained in us that it's hard to let go of what happens because of a challenge, because of successfully surviving a challenge.
So let's look at the third part of it, the divinity. He says, in seeking bliss and immortality, humans are in fact trying to upgrade themselves into gods. And he says that this is going to happen through biological engineering, cyborg engineering, and the engineering of non-organic beings. So what was your sense that, you know, we're all going to become gods with a small g?
there's this really terrible movie, Gods of Egypt, that I tried to watch because there's a podcast that makes fun of movies that had it on there. I couldn't even finish the thing. And but in it, there are these characters that supposedly in ancient Egypt, that these gods were actual people, right, is the thing that the movie posits. And they're like twice as tall as the other people there. And they have these special powers and those kinds of things. And so I see it as more that, because that's a possibility in the future, is to slowly be able to turn human beings who can't afford it genetically into beings that are actually far better mentally and physically than the class that can't. And gods might not be the right word for it in the future, but there's the possibility of getting to a point where to those who have not been upgraded, it may seem like godlike powers.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think one of the themes is that this has been going on. And he points out that in the last 250 years, humans have really dominated the earth and they've pushed other organisms aside. And gods kind of, I never think of gods as being blissful creatures. I think of them as having very difficult jobs, if they have jobs at all, you know. So I think being a human comes with a lot of responsibility. So that's kind of my version of God, is that with much control, with much power comes much need for stewardship.
We're going to go into that a little bit more, but I want to let our listeners know that they're listening to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio, 89.7, and we're talking about Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Noah Harari. So, you know, what you're talking about is, I mean, superhero movies are huge, right? People flock to those. And so it's almost that, I'm getting a sense of that's almost what we're talking about here, that these are people who have some incredible abilities or powers, and so mm-hmm. how do they use those? And I don't, Harari doesn't really say that. I'm just getting, you know, kind of the sense from what you guys are saying.
So when you look at popular culture and the things that we are obsessed with and fantasize about, like right now, oftentimes it is end of world type scenarios, because we're facing a lot of different really big threats, you know, climate change, overpopulation, and there's still nukes hanging out in the background at all times. And then these superhero kind of things where what happens when folks have the abilities to do A, B, and C? And, you know, how do they treat us? And Harari points out a very good example of us and how we treat lesser beings, including other humans, human species that existed in the past. You know, and the we wipe out or subjugate other humans that we consider to be less than, and that has been, you know, historically pretty consistent. At this point, at all those points, though, that difference has been made up and false. We've believed ourselves to be ahead of whoever the dominating force is, but truly we all had about the same physical and mental capacity. A more analogous relationship is us to pigs or cows, you know, because these are species that don't raise up to our level of mental capabilities and physical capabilities, and we see what has happened with them. So what is the reality when something expands beyond us? And we've talked about the pigs thing.
Yeah, well, and we'll get into the animal thing more too. But so with that being said, are you thinking then that the argument is that when there's these more these humans that have been upgraded, they'll, you know, we'll just repeat that pattern of they'll subjugate the people who have not been upgraded.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the arguments. And that's kind of one of the fears that comes along with this. When you begin to think of yourself, if you put yourself, what do pigs have, hooves? If you put yourselves in the pig's hooves, it really hits home that that a intelligent, social, emotionally needy, curious mammal that's very similar to us, in probably more respects than not, can be used for our purposes and kind of solely used that way on a grand scale. Whether it be superhumans or artificial intelligence or this, we'll talk about the data network. We could be seen as resources, and our notion of created human rights may go away pretty quick.
Yeah, it does open a lot of doors. So, in having this conversation, then I wanted to just back it up a minute too, so we can, you know, look at what is human, and do you think Harari defines that? Do you think that in talking about these kind of upgraded humans, it takes away the humanity?
I think the definition that I settle on with human, aside from the biological definition of a species, and I think that he does really points out that humans are able to observe and communicate about reality and organize around reality, but they're also able to create fiction and stories and organize around that. So that allows us to have the previously mentioned human rights that we benefit from. It allows us to have our political system. It allows us to have our legal system, our monetary system. And that, to me, when I thought about that question, that's kind of how I, beyond a DNA, you know, biological definition, I think it's how we've organized and how that put us where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting that we have over time, as an adjective, attributed human to the so many different things that are associated with like how we feel and strive and how we err and flaw and these kinds of things, you know. And so I wondered about this a bit. I did not put down an answer because I am not entirely sure beyond the species thing. But that was how I felt about it, that this group, this species has turned into something a little bit more through what we'll talk about later, this intersubjective, being able to exist and think about stuff that exists only in the ether and in our imaginations. That seems to be the big separator. He posits that was what allowed us then to organize on such a large scale, was the fiction, the imagination, and being able to have a belief system based on things that nobody can see or touch. And that for me feels like what currently makes human.
So, yeah, we'll dig into, did you have another comment?
Well, and just to go back into that a little bit, that's kind of planning, seeing into the future, abstraction, self-awareness, and those things. Our brains are different. We have a gigantic frontal lobe compared to other species, so we do have that biological component. And I do want to say that when I think of the ability to organize and work together, I think that's something that data networks are going to be able to do as well. So that makes it a little bit messy.
That's true.
And that's part of what, you know, Harari's getting at, is what part of humanness needs to remain. Right. So the other thing I wanted to question is, when we talk about this immortality or turning humans into gods, do you think that that's blasphemous? Do you think people of a religious background would think what he's going too far and dismiss his whole argument because of that?
Yeah, this is kind of a complex piece of the book. I find that when he talks about religion religion historically, he has a very sarcastic tone.
Thank you for saying that, because I was going to ask you guys if he sometimes came across as cynical or, sarcastic.
I think he sees religion as a fiction created to explain things, which is in itself a certain kind of technology. And he doesn't mince words with respect to that science believes that there is, that science finds evidence for a God. Science doesn't even address really that might be a relevant theory. And so he focuses on what is empirical and what is possible versus what is believed. And he points out that there are differences between those things.
Uh-huh.
I think somebody who is of the religious persuasion may find that challenging.
Yeah, and I think that also his definition for religion makes this a fascinating question, because he sees communism also as a religion, and humanism, and then dataism, the belief that information is the ultimate and should be free and have rights and all those kinds of things. So he just sees all of that as a continuum, and so they are like beings. So just because the set of beliefs has, humans at the forefront of what gives us meaning and what gives us power, versus the story before being that it was a god or gods that gave us meaning and power, it's all the same. And I think that is what would bother a lot of folks, because once you ascribe yourself, and it should bother humanists too, because he also attacks that.
Mm-hmm.
And says that the idea that the universe is in some ways like meant to serve us essentially, and anything that serves our goals is good, and anything that does not is bad, and that has become the new goal. And that he also decries that as bad. So, but humanists don't hold some things as tightly as, monotheists do a lot of times.
Well, I was challenged by, I consider myself a humanist. So when some of those things I thought, he's asking me to, think about this differently or let it go. And yeah, it was challenging. So I just thought for people with, more of a religious background, they would have that same kind of challenge. But it's that same progression. I think it's, maybe that's a piece of what makes us human, is the question, what is the meaning of all this? What is the meaning of life? And searching for that and trying to come up with some narrative that satisfies us at whatever point in history we're at.
Yeah. And he says that the current deal that whether or not we knew we entered into it of humanism was that we gave up meaning for power.
Right.
And I found that to be one of the more fascinating premises in there, which is that acknowledgement of this set of beliefs means that we can move forward at a drastic rate with our capabilities and those kinds of things. But we have to understand that if the greatest meaning is that which is within us, and going deeper, utilizing a therapist rather than trying to touch the universe, going to a priest, it does somehow kind of minimize our ability to be powerful in that way, and be tied to something much greater and more meaningful than ourselves that will continue on for eternity. If the meaning is just here, it feels awfully temporary.
And small, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how much can that touch, really?
So what happens to people that want to find themselves?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is very ethereal discussion. I mean, like, right. How do you can't live according to a lot of these. You'd just be, an alcoholic human destruction machine if you, if you went down this path as far as it could take you. You right. have to choose what things you're going to live by, and they're not always going to be based on these outsized theories of what's going on.
And he does such a good job, even in this conversation, I feel this, he does such a good job of setting this book up so that while you're talking about something in the moment, you're also talking about something that may happen in the future, and you feel yourself anchored in where we've been. I really appreciate that technique.
Wow. Okay. We're going to get into this some more. I want to let our listeners know that they're listening to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. We are talking about Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Noah Harari. So let's touch on this idea then of, you know, in upgrading humans, bioengineering, the cyborg science that's out there. Because I think, like you said, the point you just made, Matt, that when these things are happening now, so we can sort of see the future because these things are just starting to come into, you know, the public arena where people are becoming more aware of it. And so the big things that I think we're struggling with then is what are the ethics behind it? And I think that that's what's held us back in a lot of the moving forward with it. There was a new story, and Harari uses the example, too, about the three-parent babies, where, you have the egg from the woman, the sperm from the man, but there's some kind of genetic defect. And so they take DNA from a third individual that will correct that defect. And so this child actually has DNA from three parties.
So, yeah, here we go on that. That's the people that have money are going to be able to do that, and the people that aren't are not. So we're going to see a split, more of a stratification in the class structure. And I love ethics. I love talking about ethics, especially in therapy. It comes up a lot. And it's really really comes down to who you're talking with and who's, ethics are kind of a might makes right subject sometimes. And so I just wonder if the people that have the means are going to be defining what the ethics are, you know. And I think that's probably one of the biggest struggles. It also pulls us away. I think it's very risky to jettison the natural properties that govern things like natural selection, that have maintained species and kept them at an equilibrium for eons. And when we start full-scale allowing for more and more and more genetic engineering and kind of hacking into that system, we need to make sure that we're doing that intelligently without pulling ourselves away from what is, in my estimation, the actual God, which is Mother Nature and the biological constructs that we're made of. So that's the thing that I worry about is 300 years is not much time. Modern medicine is pretty young. And while I wish to see it utilized, I just want to make sure we stay grounded in the science that is the foundation.
So really quick, for anybody who's never heard of it or looked it up, you should check out CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. And I looked it up so I could say that it's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats.
Oh, you didn't just know that off the top of your head.
Yeah. So this is what they have discovered within the last like 5-6 years, which allows them to essentially unzip DNA and then re-zip a second half onto it in order to change genetic traits of beings. And they've already been successful in doing this. And one guy actually found a way to do it in such a way so that if that thing then had offspring, it would have the same traits. So they did find a way to make it in perpetuity. So as far as ethical, one thing that comes to mind within the next 40, 50 years is going to be what are the rights of future humans, fetuses and babies, and zygotes who are potentially going to be edited because they have no opportunity to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And just as there is temptation to utilize this kind of thing for positive stuff, There's always going to be somebody out there who's willing to use it for negative things. Mm-hmm. So you can potentially be born with, say, emotional and physical attributes that are going to make you a violent warrior. And you have no choice in that, say. And that's, you know, the role that you were expected to then play. That's a fascinating thing. So the living people who create these, do they just get to say? And then you're born with an extra ear and, you know, well, that's how it was. And then, you know, past that, we already talked about, you know, what are the ethics going to be for those who I wrote down my little example, like, who can calculate pi to the 200th place in their head when they're 5 years old, mm-hmm. and, you know, go up to eight feet and, you know, all these different crazy things that would be possible over time, and how they treat us, who, you know, because I'm not one of them.
I think that danger is certainly there. And I think it speaks to the values, you know, whatever culture has that implements it. Because we can look at China, we can look at other countries where they value male children. And so what we've seen is a higher incident of abortion with female fetuses. And so that's a true to life application that we've already seen. And so, and certainly, you know, some parents who are now looking at aborting a fetus because of some malfunction or, you know, mm-hmm. genetic defect that they identify. So that's certainly there. So using that same kind of thinking is if we only value or we define our values as the person who can, you know, calculate pi to the 200th point or, you know, 8 feet tall people, that those are the things that are going to be looked for, right? So it's really going to go back to that determination of how do we define what's human and what's valuable as humans.
Exactly. And ethics come from what your values are. That's where they're derived. And so that's another theme, is it just seems like one thing that keeps coming up is there's going to be a class differentiation, and people are going to have things done to them because they're valued in different ways than other people.
Yeah. And I liked how he tied it into loving your children, because say that the people around you are upgrading their kids, and you want yours to be competitive in the job market and in school, and you can afford it, you would have to knowingly put them at a disadvantage if other people are doing it. Like, yes, we do keeping up with the Joneses on everything else.
Why this not guy's this? A historian, a psychologist, and a marketer all in one. He's well-rounded. Yeah, I thought that was the great guilt play, right? Harari says that the study of history aims above all to make us aware of the possibilities we don't normally consider. Historians study the past not in order to repeat it, but in order to be liberated from it. So this kind of goes along with what we're talking about. So do you agree with that? Because I've never heard it said that way before.
Yeah, I do. And Peter, you might need to help me with the podcast that you recently clued me into. Was it Revisionist
History?
Yeah. And so I don't commute for work, but when I cut the grass, I listen to podcasts. That's when I do it. So I get about once a week, and this is one I'm into now. And I just love when my assumptions are shattered. I really appreciate that. So first of all, like, how do we define, or how do we look at history, and who wrote that history is one thing that's interesting to consider here. But I think of history as access to your ancestors' journals, maybe, you know, what happened, what were the forces at play? And so I used to journal a lot. I don't so much anymore, but when I was coming up and in my 20s, I would often go back and look at those journals, and I would say, you know, I survived that, or I went through that, or I thought this was going to be great and it wasn't. And it really allowed me to, not escape my history or not avoid it, but just to grow from it. So it sounds a little bit simplistic, but I think of history as access to our ancestors' journals.
So that's not really liberated from it.
No.
I mean, that seems like a liberated from it seems like cutting off from it.
It's having a relationship with it.
Okay. So you see it as different.
Okay. And so he says the study of history. And so, I mean, he's talking about historians. I think in this instance is one where he is reflecting onto everybody else his own aims in studying it. Because it seems through his writing, he does seem to be attempting to educate the reader in such a way as to potentially spread these ideas that will keep us, that will help us make the best decisions moving forward. But a lot of historians just really dig history, and like finding a new link between this thing and that thing is exciting. And I think that that's probably, I don't know if it's most historians, but I think that there are probably multiple motivations. And the study of history is really a goal in and of itself, because we like to know more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always take things that I learn about what happened in history and try and apply it to my decisions, because I'm never going to be in the Second Punic War, you know, but it's still fascinating to read about those things.
Yes. I like your point about that, because I think what he's trying to do is liberate us from this idea about how we define or describe meaning. And so he's trying to make that cut and say, you know, we can't accept any longer that it's because of us as human beings. And he's trying to move us now to this other idea that it's going to be data that's going to be the new religion or the new meaning in the world. So maybe it is his own personal thing that he's ascribing then to historians in general. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So another term he uses, and I've heard it, you know, in podcasts and other things too, is the Anthropocene, that this is the era that we're in. And so he discusses the impact humans have had on the earth and introduces this idea then that organisms are just really algorithms. And algorithms are a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations. And a lot of the examples he uses our computers, but also just even like how we write out a recipe for cooking something. So had you guys heard that term before, Anthropocene, and how it applies?
I had to look it up. It sounds like what it is. what is that? Onomatopoeic?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like us kind of taking over and doing some harm, doing some good. But and I had heard algorithm. I had never heard it applied to people like he did it. It's kind of a fulcrum for him. It really leverages a lot of his arguments. And this is where, you're right, he's a really good marketer or a salesman. He can really gently put the knife in your side while he's kind of patting you on the back at the same time. And he talks about feelings as our best algorithm so far. Like, our feelings are what got us out of danger. Our feelings are what kept us breeding. Our feelings are what kept us eating food and foraging. And I thought that was really, really cool. A good way to put that. And then he jumps and he says, it's now time to look at data as our best algorithm and not trust our feelings, because data can understand us more than we even understand ourselves. So, a little bit off the topic here, but I think that as a therapist who, you know, we work with people and we think about different components of how people structure their psyche, like their cognitive abilities and their emotional abilities and their somatic or their bodily feelings. He just breaks all those down into, these are just processes that you sometimes maybe not ever have control over like you think you do. So that was an interesting thing for me professionally to think about, because I think about those things as processes too. We have thoughts that generate access our belief and generate feelings, and if we can kind of pull those pieces out as bits of data and then adjust one, it adjusts another one. So I can't argue with him on that. Honestly, I think that we are actually algorithms. I kind of wish we weren't. I wish we had more of our own agenda at play. But
I want to talk about that more. But I just want to do a quick station identification. You're listening to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. We're talking about Homo Deus: A Brief History of Tomorrow. So it almost sounds like you've reconciled it to some degree, because I, as a psychologist too, I had a real hard time. I thought, what? He's saying that, you know, it, and I could agree, because a lot of times in my work, what I look for is patterns of behavior. I'm looking for, you know, how do you consistently, you know, sabotage relationships, or how do you consistently form this kind of relationship? And so I'm trying to get people to see their patterns. And so I think that that's almost true. Then they're following some type of algorithm. But the next part of it is, I think that he takes it to is, it's almost like a faded kind of thing. So going back to, you know, what you said earlier, Peter, about, you know, with the, you know, if we monkey around with genetics and as a fetus, they have no say in, you know, what kind of person they're going to be born as to. I think he's saying that we're already that. We're already such a creature of our situations and our in embedded algorithms that we don't have a lot of say.
Yeah, and I've had over the past year and a half a really difficult but fascinating time in coping with some stuff that I read about free will. And the high likelihood that if we are not totally bound by our circumstance and, you know, genetic propensity, then at least almost entirely, you know, and that the only thing really at play is, you know, chance is the guidance of everything. And he talks about in this book how you can see the thought being formed long before the person actually recognizes that they have the thought.
Oh, from fMRI machines, mm-hmm. You mean? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So you can recognize in somebody what they're going to think actually like seconds, which in the brain is a really long time before they have the thought and then express it. And so while they think that it has just arrived there, or they came to that conclusion, a lot of times they came to that conclusion before they realized they did. And that is very, very important. And there's a number of other examples as well. But the idea that organisms are algorithms, I think it pushes towards a more unified theory of the universe as well. Because if physics and all these things are mathematical, then if humanity is as well, then it really kind of ties us more to everything that's going on. And so I'm trying to be okay with that and be okay with trying to make decisions, even believing that my decisions aren't necessarily my own, which is fascinating.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
it's humbling just to incorporate a little bit of that in, you know, that you don't have a say to the family you're born into and how you're raised and all of those other things that we all know about. And those are algorithmic. That's a formula. That's an equation that produces something. And humanism really teaches us that we have free will and we have our own direction. And so that's nice. That sounds kind of nice. You know, I'm in charge of my life completely. But I think it's helpful to incorporate a little bit of maybe not completely. And sometimes I think that I'm making a decision because I want to, but I'm making that decision because there's an equation that's got a whole bunch of stuff out here to my left and I'm at the other end of the equal sign right now. So.
And I think when you're on the computer is just the perfect example of this, because it's got all that stuff running on one side, you know, the clickbait and the ads that from whatever, you know, websites you've surfed, that they know that's what your interests are. And so they're already mining us for, you know, our algorithms and what we're interested in and what we're likely to, you know,
click on.
Do. What's that?
Click on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, the thing is also then if you choose, I just made air quotes, to not click on that thing, that's also a result of the algorithms in you that have made you anti-advertising or not want to be subject to the advertisers. And they also, not long ago, they started advertising to people who dislike advertisements through wink advertising is what they call it, where they're advertising and it's obviously kind of a corny upfront, but they toss in there something that winks at people who know that it is not like a good advertisement, and that is how they advertise to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're messing with us. But, and some of the other research he talked about where, you know, with enough, if people go into Facebook and they click a number of likes, that the computer can start to predict what they'll like better than their family or friends, depending on how much they've clicked on.
And it doesn't take that many likes. It doesn't take as many as you would think. I think it was less than 100.
It was 10 for some nominal percentage of getting you accurately. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he does. He talks. I listened to a couple of his interviews as well. And he, I don't know if it's in the book, but he talks somewhere about that Facebook is really valuable politically right now because it can predict, it can tell politicians who is leaning their way, who's not, where to focus their marketing. And he had a meeting with some of the management team at Facebook, and they said we're not selling that, we're not interested in that right now, but we totally can. We can run the election process with the free data that everybody provides us. And he talks about data as being your most valuable asset, and that we give it freely in exchange for funny cat videos. But but I think what you brought up about chance, Peters, that's fascinating to me. And if you think about it in terms of an algorithm, it's almost as if our choice and our decision in response to chance or luck or what just happens to us is the result of our pre-programming. You know? Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you were getting at there?
Yeah, the real factor that makes unpredictable changes in the system is only chance. That
right.
You can't make a decision that you weren't going to make. But the circumstances can change based on the universe is full of flips of the coin. That all the time there are things that we can't necessarily predict. And, you know, that could end up being wrong. Maybe, you know, the idea that chance is a factor in the way things play out isn't the case. And then maybe it's just God's plan, you know.
Right.
But who knows?
Do either of you read Gladwell at all when he talks about outliers? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that. I mean, he credits most outliers where they end up based on chance. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates, right. It was because he lived in a town where they had built one of the first computers, and he went to a school that just happened to allow high school students to go over to that college campus to work on those computers. And
unlimited access from like 10 p.m. until 6 a.m.
Yeah,
or something
and
like
so
that. Yeah.
Just that point exactly, that a lot of the reason people got to where they're at is because of just luck.
Yeah. And it just is fascinating because there are other people in Bill Gates' shoes who would not have done that. They would have, you know, played Atari or whatever you did back then.
Oh, so you really want to hang on to free will here.
I think it's a good discussion. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah you know, there's that theory of the right man at the right time kind of thing. That not necessarily would somebody have taken, Napoleon Bonaparte's place had he not taken that mantle kind of thing. Like the history was prime for that. But it could have looked entirely different, or it could have waited another 60 years before anybody made those kinds of moves.
We only have a few minutes left. Is there anything that that's just burning you want to talk about today? Because we're going to have to do part two on this book.
Yeah, we're going to have to do it again.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that we might get off on another tangent. I just would like to reiterate for the listeners that this is a really, really good book to read if you want to have your assumptions challenged. That's my perspective. So I would encourage that.
Which I think is always a healthy thing to do. It's very, very easy to get into a space where we have these basic precepts in our lives that we don't challenge. And then other things are fair game, but this basic stuff is not. And you can learn a little bit, but it's only when, you shake things down, to your core that you can then reevaluate where you're at and make, you know, true progress. But that's not something that matters to everybody. But if folks are deliberately listening to this podcast, this show, I imagine that, that is to them.
And be careful with the, if you do read it and you talk about, how we treat pigs. Be careful when you do that and who you do that with.
I was going to say, because it sounds like you guys have done a lot of talking, at least between the two of yourselves. So, but you've annoyed other people, I think you said, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a couple of days. I had a number of days where I was just really depressed thinking about a lot of these things, just trying to mull them over and deal with the realities of some of it. And, you know, I just had to tell my fiance what the deal was with that and that it had nothing to do with her. You know, it was just that I was trying to cram a whole lot of questioning who I am and what I'm doing into like a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's that kind of book for sure.
Certainly the book, yes, that you would want to have like your book club discuss or readily available, other people who've read it, so you could, or not even not, maybe not, just to present an idea to somebody and say, I want to chew on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because you brought the pig thing up, I just want to check, did either of you become vegetarians or at least not eat, you know, pork anymore?
I am currently only eating like pork that I know where it came from.
Like a pig?
Like there's a place up in Delta Junction, like that I know that they're raising their pigs okay.
And they live outside and they get to be in the air.
And so I'm like, if they have a life before I eat them, I'm like learning to be okay with that, you know. But I did cut down a lot on it because just in general, I feel like causing potential suffering through global warming to other folks. Which, you know, meat production is a huge participator in that, is not good. And then it's not necessarily good for my health. And then, that there are ethical issues with meat, too. So some kind of control is a good thing.
Yeah, same here. My wife and I discussed that section, and she came back around to the idea that we should be more sensitive to that as well. So we're moving in a direction of just eating fish and meat that I hunt. I'm a hunter.
So wow.
That,
so life changing.
We're kind of, you know, but changes are hard. So we'll see. Maybe we can check back in on that.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time I was reading that, I was reading a book called Like Water for Chocolate, which is a Mexican writer. It's a magical realism. And she talks about baking a cake, a wedding cake for her sister. And her sister's going to marry her love. And so as she's baking the cake, she's crying and her tears are going into the cake. And so when the cake is served to all the wedding guests, the guests all have feeling of deep desolation and sadness. And so I thought, you know, that's what kind of what he's getting at, too. And what we know about when animals are under stress, what happens to, you know, what's being discharged into their body with their stress hormones. And then they butcher it and then you eat it. So I just want to say I've been a vegetarian since I was 14.
Wow.
So I'm off the hook. So thank you guys so much. Holy smokes. What a lot to talk about. I just want to let the listeners know we got to like number 9 out of 32 questions. So we're going to do part 2, but I don't know. We might have to, I don't know, part 7. So I want to thank Peter and Matt for joining me today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
And the book was Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. It sounds like we're all recommending it to everybody who would want to read it. We probably will air the second part most likely in September, but I'll keep listeners informed. Next month, we're going to discuss Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? It's a story about women and economics by Katrine Markall. My guest will be Holly Bell. She's a professor in economics. I also want to remind listeners that 89.7 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing or a sustaining member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.